Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements, and we're going to be with you for the next hour talking about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden for the next hour. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning, gents.
Hey, you know what? Last week we were talking about the loss of Nuccio's Nurseries, an outstanding chameleon azalea grower up in the Altadena area, and it reminded me there's a botanical garden up in that area called Descanso Gardens. And there's a really good TV show. I think you can find it. I think it's available on Prime, called Lost LA. And they go through and they do stories about different parts of Los Angeles and things that had happened in the past there. But they did one on Descanso Gardens, which is still open, but Descanso has always been known for their camellia collection. And I've never been there. One of the places on my list that I need to go see. But the show that they did on Lost LA about Descanso Gardens was really interesting. And they got their camellia collection at the outbreak of World War II, when the order was given to inter the Japanese families in California and across the country. And there were a lot of Japanese nurseries up in the San Gabriel Valley, up in that area. Descanso Gardens went through and bought the inventories of a lot of those nurseries to help those families out, and then planted all the camellias at the gardens in up there. And so that was, and one of the people that was involved with that was their former superintendent of the garden, was a gentleman named Howard Asper. And at some point in time, he moved to Escondido and opened a nursery. And I don't know if it's still there or not, but it was just south of Deer Springs Road on the east side of Interstate 15. And he grew proteas and camellias. And that's what they were known for, was proteas and camellias. So yeah, it was Howard Asper's was there. So kind of a tie-in to everything that we were talking about last week.
Yeah, a lot of protea stuff last week. You know, what's interesting, Ken, is we've talked about the Descanso Gardens in the past, and you and I have talked about making that a field trip.
Yes.
We still haven't gone up.
No,
we
have not.
When are we going?
Let's just do this. Let's just go.
Let's go do it. We'll do the Huntington and Descanso in the same day. How's that?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you can do that, because the Huntington.
Boy, that's a 3-day.
And the LA Arboretum's on the way.
Ooh, you know? That's right there too.
Yeah.
Oh, and speaking of the Huntington, when we were talking about Michelia, they have, and I think Monrovia used to grow it, but they don't grow it anymore, at Michelia foggii.
Yes.
And that is a tremendous tree. And blooms like crazy. Mm-hmm. The amount of flowers that are on that is just absolutely amazing. They had a really, really nice specimen there. And I've been trying to find it it's probably about 6 or 7 years ago that we went up to the Huntington, and I've been trying to find that ever since. And I have not been able to find it.
Well, you know, one of the ideas that I would love us to do sometime is talk about Japanese gardens. Japanese garden is just a genre for me. It's among my favorite things in the world are Japanese gardens.
Oh, I love them. I love them.
And, you know, Japanese gardens were so popular in the late 1800s and really the turn of the century. And there were many, many, many around. There were two just on Coronado Island, and they were very famous, really well done. And of course, you know what led to their undoing was politics, because, of course, after World War II, the attack on Pearl Harbor, people did not want to have Japanese gardens around, and many of them were destroyed, which is
very unfortunate,
sad. There was one right behind John Spreckel's mansion on Coronado that he installed, in fact, one of the best Japanese gardens in the world. And it was a tourist destination.
Outside of Japan, I would
Outside
say.
Of Japan, okay. Yes.
I lived there for seven years, so I had the opportunity.
Do Japanese gardens
they
pretty
well. Yeah, they learned from us. Yeah,
do they have American gardens in Japan?
I wonder if they do. How would you describe They serve
Actually,
hot dogs?
They do. I lived in Japan for 7 years, and so there are a lot of, like, eclectic things, just like here.
Yeah, you know? But just fascinating, and a guy named Howard Marsh had another Japanese garden on the north end of Coronado Island. And he imported Japanese artifacts and antiques. All the stuff that's at the Huntington was actually purchased by him and then procured by Henry Huntington. So anyway, that would be a great show sometime.
That would be a great field trip, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. The Japanese garden at Huntington is
spectacular.
Is really quite spectacular. Nice. They have a very nice Japanese, I wouldn't call it a Japanese garden, but a Japanese section of the Sarah Duke Botanical Garden back at Duke University in North Carolina that we've been to. My daughter lives in Durham, so we've been there a few times. It's a beautiful, absolutely beautiful garden, well worth visiting. And it's huge, and it's sectioned off into different themed sections. And they do have a big section of it that is a Japanese theme. And it's I want to say around 1995 or 1996, we put in a huge Japanese garden exhibit at the fairgrounds. I think that was the last time we did it, but it was really spectacular. And it had the raked crushed granite. Ooh, and yeah.
Little Zen garden.
Yeah, exactly. Little Zen garden. It was I wish I had pictures of it. I don't think I have any photos of it, but it was beautiful. And at that time, the fair had one of the props that they had for the garden show was a structure that was somewhat reminiscent of a pagoda, but it was like a little patio area. And so they brought that over and set that up. As a matter of fact, we actually broadcast an episode of Garden Talk when we were on KFMB. And at that time, Lauren Ann Carroll was the host of the show. And we set up a remote from the pagoda in our display and did the show from there. It was pretty neat. It was a fun time. But that was a really fun exhibit to put in. And they are beautiful. They are really, really pretty. The Japanese garden. And locally, go to the Japanese Friendship Garden.
Yeah.
In Belleville Park. It is really pretty. It's very, very gorgeous. Nicely done. Yeah. And it's hidden. Mm-hmm. The entrance is up on the mesa, just adjacent to the organ pavilion, but the garden itself drops way down into the canyon behind there.
Which is why those Japanese maples can survive there and not in the full sun anywhere else, really.
Yeah, it is really pretty. It is well worth a visit to go check that out.
So. You know, and when that was really reinstituted, the Asakawa family came here originally for the 1915 exposition. And Moto Asakawa was 3 years old. I have some photos of him.
Oh, wow.
They had a Japanese tea garden behind is now the Botanic Building in what's now the Children's Zoo. And there's some beautiful photos of Moto when he was just a kid there. And his parents ran that Japanese tea garden. And that's the connection with the Asakawa family coming here for that. And then Moto was instrumental in starting the Japanese Friendship Garden in Balboa Park. So it's... You know, everything comes full circle.
It does.
That's very interesting. Yeah, on a future show, we haven't booked it yet, but we're going to have Glenn Asakawa, who is one of Moto's sons, the brother of the late Bruce Asakawa. He's going to come on the show along with my dad. They've known each other forever, so that'll be a nice show talking about the history of the families, because they were friendly competitors of ours for years when Presidio Nursery was open, and just some of the nicest people you've ever met. Wonderful, wonderful people.
Can I solicit help from our listeners before we move forward?
Yes, please do.
So, John, last week I brought you a bunch of sweet limes because the week before, I think you had mentioned how much you like them, right?
Yes.
And then our guest today, I brought some for her as well. But, and John, and Ken, you've had some, and, I have this beautiful sweet lime tree, Palestine sweet lime tree in our yard that my wife hates and thinks that we should get rid of it. She finds no purpose in it. So I need recipes and ideas from our listeners that might use them. Because we have people come in asking to purchase them regularly. Do you sell them? So we, you know, there is a need for them out there from folks, but apparently not at my house other than me. and it's a great tree. And
it's a pretty piece of fruit.
It's too. A great piece of fruit. And so the question comes to why should I keep it in my yard? So I need some help. So if you have any ideas, see me at the nursery or drop us a note at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com because I'm curious for some good recipes to keep this. In the conversation I had with my wife, she went online uses for, and she found a number of people who did nothing but complain about them. And I think I mentioned to you, John, somebody had said that if you've never had this particular piece of fruit, the juice is similar to making a gallon of weak limeade and then diluting it with 3 gallons of water.
Oh,
so I disagree with that. I like it.
And I implore you like it. Capri, are you listening? Please, please keep George's sweet Palestine lime tree. I like it.
Well, if nothing else, we'll keep it for you, maybe.
Yes, I'll
use that as my argument, right? There we go. All right. That was my plea to our
But folks, send recipes so that George can keep his tree. We're going to start a fund to save the George Allman sweet Palestine lime tree.
Thank you, John. Appreciate that.
Yeah. And if you have any suggestions or questions that you'd like us to cover on the air, feel free to drop us an email. We would be more than happy to hear from you. And we will get to your questions as they come in on a future show. And as George said, that's gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. And Anderson is spelled S-E-N, not S-O-N. There is a walteranderson.com that is S-O-N.
That's not us.
It's not us. Right. And the gentleman that has that URL is nice enough to forward
periodically
things that come to him that actually were intended to come to us. But yeah.
And before we introduce our guest, we have a class today. It's Orchids in Poway, and that's with Chuck McClung.
Oh.
And, you know, he's got his couple books, one of which is How to Get Your Orchids to Rebloom. It's a very popular class, and it's informative, and you typically walk out feeling more confident that you can make your orchids rebloom that you got for Mother's Day or Valentine's Day that typically die by the end of the summer. He'll make you be successful with it.
They're really not that hard.
They're not, no. But people have a fear of them. It's like
they think they're too exotic.
Exactly. Or, you know, exactly.
And a lot of people,
I think it's too much love.
Exactly. They baby them too much because most of the orchids were at least the ones that you see in production, grow in some of the harshest climates around the world. I mean, just miserable locations, but they do very well. Most of them are pretty easy to grow. There are some that are a little trickier, but for the most part, they really are very, very easy to grow.
You know what it is? It's a bunch of hype. That orchid growers want you to sort of have this orchid growing mystique.
They want a fear behind it. That's so they have to solicit their help for everything.
There you go. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to be back with our special guest, Brigitte Pena from San Diego Seed Company. And we'll be talking to her right after this. So stay tuned.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. Ken Anderson along with George Allman, John Clements. And we have a special guest in the studio today. We have Brigitte Pena from San Diego Seed Company. Welcome, Brigitte.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here at my old stomping grounds.
Well, we're happy to have you back, and thanks for making the time to come in and talk to us. So you are one of the owners of San Diego Seed Company, which you started six or 7 years ago?
Oh, no.
Longer than that.
I was still in college. So we're going on almost like 15 years now.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't realize you had been around that long. Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Outstanding company, locally grown, locally sourced vegetable seeds.
And flower seeds.
Yep. And herbs.
All done locally. So I think that's amazing that you can do that in San Diego and find the space to do that. Hey.
Well, interestingly, San Diego is one of the best locations to do it because seed production, we can get so much production out of a very small space. So like our Ramona farm is only 6 acres, mm-hmm. but we really only produce on 3 of it. And because we're a small company, I don't need a literal ton of seeds. I might need 2-3 pounds of a tomato seed. Mm-hmm. And if you're an avid gardener, you know that, you know, 1 75-foot row of really well-cared tomatoes will give you upwards to 1, 2, maybe even 3 pounds of seed, depending on the seed crop.
And a pound of tomato seed is a lot of seeds.
Yep.
That is a lot of seeds. That speaking of tomatoes, how do you get the tomato varieties to come true from seed?
So it's a great question. The majority of the varieties that we do are going to be more modern varieties where the flower is actually shaped in a way that cross-pollination doesn't happen as rampantly.
Okay.
And it does depend on the climatic conditions. So it's fascinating to me, and this is why I'm in this industry. OSA, the Organic Seed Alliance, actually did extensive research to settle this argument that we've had in the seed industry on whether or not cross-pollination happens readily in tomato varieties. And they found, first of all, it's the shape of the tomato flower. So older varieties tend to be more open and insects can get in. And it depends on the climatic conditions and the insects present. So because we're so dry, it actually is a benefit to me as a seed producer. Whereas if you're maybe like, you know, you were talking about Durham, North Carolina, that area has way more insects because of the moist. They may have more cross pollination than we do in San Diego. So San Diego is actually a great place to do seed production. I don't know if I should tell everybody that. Everybody wants to be a seed producer. I don't recommend it, but it's a fabulous place to do it. The other reason is we don't get late season summer rains, which can totally ruin a seed crop. So like my favorite crop to do seed production of is carrots. And once those carrots start to flower, you really don't want any summer rain. Luckily for us, I mean, you know, luckily for the seeds, we don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Or sometimes winter rains.
Yeah, well, that's really causing me some underlying anxiety. Let's not bring that up.
How many varieties of seed are you producing right now? Do you know?
On the last, last year, this last season on the farm, we did 57 lots. And so, and that can be, sometimes we'll have multiple lots of one tomato, but we'll say for the sake, that's 50 varieties that we're doing.
Oh, okay.
And a variety, we can produce enough for anywhere from 1 to 5 years, depending on the yield. And so over time, we just continue to stockpile our seed bank, basically, of locally produced seeds. So, you know, in 5 years, we might be up to, you know, maybe 80% of our varieties are locally produced. We just got to keep doing it and keep at it.
Now, speaking of lots, you have to do a germination test, correct?
So, I hope you're giving me these questions. I'm just going to run with them.
Okay, no, that's fine.
I would love to tell the story of all the steps that it takes for a seed to get from seed that is either given to us or we purchase it or it's a seed that we save to a seed in the seed pack.
Oh, yeah. First, that would be a good story.
First, we do all the trialing to decide if it's worth it. So that could take 2 to 3 seasons of variety trialing it at our home garden, which is 10A, or our Ramona location, which is 9. And that's flavor testing. That's we're looking for disease resistance. We're looking how well it does in a small space. We're looking for how it does with pest pressure. Once it makes it through those gauntlet of tests and we go, we really love this variety, then we do seed production of it. And then seed production happens, which, you know, can take anywhere from 12 to 18 months by the time we grow the crop, process the crop. Then we do all of our quality testing, which is germination tests, and we do vigor tests. Some lots we have to send out to an independent lab for disease testing that we can't do in-house. Then it gets packaged, most of it by hand, most of it by my husband. Thank you so much. And other people as well.
Go, Roger.
Yes. And then it finally hits the shelf. And so it can take a very long time. And at any point during that process, we can have just really tearful upsets. I can't tell you how many times I've had a beautiful seed lot where I'm holding it in my hands and I'm thinking, this is going to be amazing seed. And then I do the germ test. That's terrible. And I just wasted a whole season of my life growing that out. We usually learn something from it, which is really great. But, you know, it's reflective of why a seed can cost what it can cost. Is there's a lot of time and energy that comes from that. And that's the cost of producing it locally.
So I have a question. Now, you're from Kansas, right? If I remember correctly.
You say that really
you're not in Kansas anymore.
No. But what I was going to say, what led you to this industry, this career, and doing it here in San Diego?
You know, I was not involved in seed at all back home. I wasn't even involved in agriculture. I grew up in a part of Kansas that was mostly GMO farms around us, very big farms. And nobody, if you weren't like a farmer's daughter, you usually weren't involved in production. But when I moved to San Diego, I took a class down at Wild Willow Farm, and they had these kids harvesting these carrots. And I'll never forget seeing this kid pull a carrot out of the ground, and like his head exploded. He had no idea the carrot came from the ground. And so it led me on this journey of just wanting to be involved with fair food and food politics. And, you know, this was like pre-college. You're going through your little tie-dye stage trying to figure out what you want to do. And I took a class with Paul Moshka down at Seeds at City, aptly named. And we were in class, and me and a friend of mine were like, hey, San Diego doesn't have a seed company. Let's start one because we're so young and naive.
We know everything about business. God. This will be easy.
Oh, we had no idea. And it's funny that you thought we'd only been around for the last like, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, because the first, you know, 5 years were just like, we were just flopping fish. We had no idea. We didn't know if we wanted to be a nonprofit. I was still going through college. You know, there's a lot of things that had to happen. But I don't know. Somehow the universe kind of just led me to it. And now I would do nothing else with my time and my life.
Well, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but you have multiple locations around San Diego that you grow in, correct?
We do. We do. So but our main one, and it's actually worked out really nicely. Our main location, which is, well, we have Ramona, which is our main production where we use tractors, and it's, you know, quote unquote, large scale.
It's the farm.
It's the farm, which my uncle, who's from Kansas, who's a real farmer, thinks that's adorable. But it is
it's
a farm.
It's so cute.
He's like, that's the size of my like garden. Yeah. But I have a tractor, so it's
a farm. It's a
farmette. Yes. And our home location, which is 1 acre, which both are certified organic. What's really nice about that is it gives me the ability to collect data that is representative of a lot of San Diego, because I've got East County. So I've got the hot, I've got the dry, but then I have the coastal influence of our home location. And that helps us decide like what varieties of tomatoes are better on the coast, where, which ones are better east, and also really give better nuanced advice about zone 9 and 10, which, you know, when you go online, you get information that's like, sow this seed, you know, 6 to 7 weeks before the last frost. And it's like, well, 6 to 7 weeks from never is never. I'm so confused.
Yeah, now what?
Yeah, right. Now what? Well, we don't have a frost. So it's nice to be able to do that. And I don't want listeners to be misled. We also have contract growers. We cannot do it by ourselves. So we have growers all over zone 9 and 10 and going up into some wetter areas where we have to use that climate, especially for like onion and seed production, or I'm sorry, onion and spinach production. But 100% of our seed is U.S. grown, which is a really big deal. Other seed companies, I'm not going to say names, but produce outside the United States for economic reasons, obviously. But I want us to be grown as locally as possible, and we're going to keep working on that.
Your oath, sorry to interrupt, your oath that you had on your website, I remember this and just brought it back up to make sure I quoted it correctly, was to produce dependable, organic, regionally adapted seeds for gardeners, farmers, and markets. And that's what you do.
Yep. That's the goal that I realize will never fully complete in my lifetime. But what I am seeing and what I'm really hopeful with our seed company is that we become a model for other smaller seed companies to be successful and to bring back how it used to be. I mean, John, you probably can remember when seed companies were regional. Before it was like, you know, they just had three varieties of corn that grew from, you know, California to Nebraska. You know, there used to be varieties, like even in my small town, you would go to the co-op and, you know, my grandpa's day and age, they would have varieties that were very specific to that area.
Well, Ken, you probably remember Charles Ledgerwood.
Yeah.
Up in Carlsbad, he had it was like a little shack, and he raised his own seed, and he was phenomenal.
Yeah,
they, very classic. It was very much like what you're doing, but 100 years ago. No, not that long ago, but a long time ago.
I didn't get to meet him because it was before my time, but it's an incredible story. And yeah, we hope to do a lot. We're very ambitious, obviously. We now have 8 employees, which is incredible.
Whoa.
We have a new warehouse, which is really cool. And we've extended our classes that we're offering. I couldn't be more pleased with what has happened in the last 5 years.
And you said that all of your growing operations are certified organic.
Correct.
And I'm assuming, but none of your crop is GMO, I take it, as well.
Correct.
Yeah.
And just to kind of help any consumer, just, you know, we have enough to worry about these days. Don't worry about your seed packs being GMO. You're not going to be able to get a GMO seed pack. If you want GMO, you're going to have to sign a contract and sign it in blood and buy very large quantities. It's going to be very expensive. It's not going to be what is in any seed pack.
We have mentioned that on a number of occasions, because the amount of GMO crops that are available is very, very narrow, and they're not crops that are produced for commodity crops.
And often, a lot of the vendors for the plant material that we sell will say on it non-GMO as a ploy, and then they assume that anything that doesn't say that must be GMO. But real quick before we go on a break, you mentioned you're doing a lot more classes. You do those around the county, but you're doing a class at Walter Anderson in Poway on the 22nd at 9:30.
Yeah, and I just
wanted to promote that.
I want to let everybody know, come show up so I can break the previous record.
which, by the way, you hold. So.
Yeah, okay. Well, so I want to hold it and break it. So come on down.
You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements and our special guest, Brigitte Pena from San Diego Seed Company. We're going to be right back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman, John Clements, and our special guest, Brigitte Pena from San Diego Seed Company. I had a question because I know that
she just mentioned tomatoes. She's going to be teaching a class on the 22nd. We have Farmer Roy coming, I think, the 1st of March, and his spring class is always tomatoes. And during your last segment, you had mentioned that your testing allows you to, you know, pick the best tomatoes for the coast versus dry inland. What would you say are some of your favorite tomatoes for those two environments?
Well, luckily, and I think John can probably speak to this too, you really can kind of categorize them by type. The smaller the tomato tends to do better on the coast, whereas anything that really wants a lot of heat, like a big, beautiful beefsteak. Now, there's always exceptions to the rule. Everybody has a microclimate. And, you know, if you can call
hot brick wall next to it makes a difference.
Yes, absolutely. You can call in and tell me I'm wrong. But what we have found from our trials is typically for coastal communities or people growing in the quote unquote fog belt tend to do better with smaller varieties, especially varieties that have more of an open canopy. So there's more airflow. So less issue with powdery mildew and different diseases. Whereas like on our Ramona farm, we get massive, beautiful beefsteaks, but it is hot out there. And it's funny because people always go like, how can you grow in such hot a climate? Well, the tomatoes love heat. And as long as they're getting enough moisture in the soil, they usually will do really well. And that's actually a crop that we focus heavily on the farm because seed production is relatively easy for that crop. And the tomatoes do so well in Ramona. So just, you know, keep those in mind. Break the rule. Prove me wrong. But that's what I. have you seen over the years, John?
I agree. Yeah.
I remember it. They haven't been in production for years now. Maybe 20 years or so. But west of Interstate 5 at Camp Pendleton.
Oh yeah.
They used to have tomatoes through that whole area, and I think those were San Diego Hybrid, which is a relatively small.
San Diego Red. Yeah.
A smaller tomato.
We get calls all the time for that particular variety. And it's funny, I worked with OSA to try to track down those particular genetics. And it's really murky, like what is the actual San Diego Red hybrid?
I think there was an Otay hybrid recall at one time. Mm-hmm. But the smaller ones, I don't know how many acres are over there on Pendleton that were in production, but that was all tomatoes when I was a kid growing up, all through there and all through Carmel Valley too.
Carmel Valley was all tomatoes in what is now the 805 down in Chula Vista. That much of that was tomato production too.
That's right. I had forgotten about that.
Do you use shade cloth at all in your tomato production in Ramona?
We have trialed doing shade cloth. And what we find is that the benefit isn't really worth the work that it takes to put it up. And we want to grow tomatoes that do really well in their native climate, right? So there's a little bit of that babying that's kind of like we were talking about the orchids. Like that extra love actually hurts them in the long run. You can just not prune as much to give more coverage. And again, the biggest thing is correct watering. We use T-tape and we water deeply and irregularly. We try to get the soils or the water down into the soil as deep as we can. Luckily, we have relatively sandy soil, so that works out.
And you mulch, I presume?
You know, interestingly, I love mulch. I'm obsessed with mulch. I'm pretty sure that like one day I'm going to figure out mulch can solve like climate change, but I'm still working on that. We don't mulch at the farm, actually. We mulch every single inch of walkway and anything outside of the actual field, but because we use plastic, and we do that for weed suppression. Mm-hmm. I hate it, but it's there's no way we can.
It's necessary at this point. Yeah.
We would not be able to have the farm if we didn't have plastic on the rows.
You know, it's interesting you say that the bigger tomatoes tend to do better in the interior parts of the county. I have tried on more than one occasion to grow beefsteak tomatoes at my house in Scripps Ranch, and I can get them to produce, but the fruit is so severely cat-faced mm-hmm. that I gave up because it wasn't worth it.
You basically
got
to take it from the plant directly to your mouth. There's no in between.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is still edible. Just
it is. Okay. Oh, yeah. It's just yeah. it's just on it's it.
It's ugly.
It's not a good look.
Yeah.
So I've always stuck with Early Girl.
Is just a
very, very easy variety to grow.
So while we're on the subject of tomatoes, I would love to share a quick little story of one of the origin story of one of our tomatoes called the Desi Sun Gold. So it's named after my son, which I hope when he gets older, he'll love that or he'll hate it. I don't know. But the tomato actually came out of the Organic Seed Alliance's TOSA project. So it was their organic tomato breeding project that they did with UC Davis, where basically they crossed thousands of plants with very traditional hybrid commercial varieties from the like Hunt's Tomato Factory that's mm-hmm. up there, and a bunch of heirlooms. And they're trying to do things like get rid of some of that cat facing, the cracking on the outside, all the things mm-hmm. that make heirlooms less appealing to most people.
Mm-hmm.
And out of the thousands and thousands of crosses, they kept whittling it down and whittling it down. And that funnel just kept, you know, producing less and less as they threw out ones that they didn't like. It was called California Sun Gold originally, came out of that project, and we trialed it at the farm for several years and fell in love with it because Sun Gold is one of my favorite tomatoes. Mm-hmm. But it is prone to splitting on top, cracking. Part of that's from watering. That's a environmental right. issue.
Mm-hmm.
But this variety does really well in the Ramona heat, even with our inconsistent watering that happens because our well is so old, sometimes it shuts off and we go out there and we do, you know, watering, where we look at the plant and go, oh shoot, we better water. And it does really well. And so this is an origin story of one nice. Of our tomatoes.
Do we have those down there in seed?
You should.
Okay.
If not, I will get with Rebecca. I'm sure it happens.
Tell us about if people want to save seeds on their own, out yeah. of their own yard. What's the process?
Not
for doing
to cut
that?
Into your business.
No.
Look, I'm the worst salesman ever because I will tell people how to do exactly what I do. I leave no illusion to the, you know, to the mysteries of seed saving. Anybody and everybody should seed save. It's part of how I got into this mess in the first place. And the most important thing that you need to know is that you need to save from an open pollinator, an heirloom variety, if you want a true to type. Now, there's a lot of, we could get into, you know, a long-winded story about genetics, but the overarching idea is that if you save from an open pollinated variety and you only have one of those varieties in your garden, it should be true to type. What I tell gardeners all the time is, do you really care if it's exactly what the other,
right.
you know, tomato was? In fact, that's how some really cool varieties have come to be. Waltham Butternut Squash was a random squash that happened in an insurance salesman's backyard. I don't know, somewhere in Ohio, or I don't know, one of those flyover states. No offense,
like Kansas,
yes. And that's how that variety came to be. So saving seeds is magical, and it's really a fun way to be able to get something that you can propagate from. And I'm always about getting people to participate in agriculture and horticulture in any way, shape, or possible, whether it's saving your own seeds, growing your own camellias, protea, whatever. Get out there and garden, because it's I mean, to me, it's magical. And I think it does a lot of good for all of us.
Yeah, it can be very fulfilling.
Well, it's therapeutic and, yeah, and good physical exercise. So,
but, you know, yeah, I will have to admit, I am not one to grow stuff from seed. I don't know if I'm just lazy or I don't want to take the time to do it. But I don't grow anything from, well, I take that back. We did plant sugar snap peas from seed this year, along with some sweet peas, but that's the first time I've actually put seeds in the ground, and I can't remember the.
And not to tease you, but my toddler also did that this year. So that's not like the most advanced seed starting.
So what you're saying is it's not a big deal.
No. I love it, but in all fairness, like I think I would expect more from you.
I heard baby steps is what I heard. We'll get there, true. Right? You know, you had mentioned that everybody, you're the worst salesperson for your stuff because you help people gather seeds. I was at Mount Vernon this past summer, I think, or October. And there's a quote from George Washington. He was telling one of the farmhands that it is miserable for a farmer to be obligated to buy his seeds or to exchange his seeds. And he just feels that, you know, after the first year, after the first year, you should never, ever buy your seeds.
Yep.
You have to do it once.
Yep.
And that's it.
Yeah, so, I agree. And I think we're going to see more and more people become interested in all of those processes. Like post-COVID, we saw people, you know, becoming way more interested in gardening and baking their own bread and all of those things. And I think as more traditional systems start to fail, people will start saving more and more seeds, which is great. That's fabulous. And in fact, some of our varieties we get from people who save seeds and then share them with us. And that's how a variety comes to be. Our Point Loma Pop sweet pea, which is consistently sold out because we can't keep it in stock, that came from a lady who saved sweet pea seeds in Point Loma, hence the name, for 20 years. And the powdery mildew resistant on this variety is fabulous because it's been growing in the fog belt for 20 years.
If somebody was going to plant a garden and start it from seed, what time frame would be ideal for them to start getting ready and start that process?
Well, luckily for us, and I tell people all the time, this is why we pay so much money to live here. You can grow 365 days a year.
Absolutely. Yes.
So you can start seeds at any point, but you will be the most successful if you start the right varieties at the right time. Luckily, we have a calendar that we print up every single year that tells you exactly that month what seeds you should be starting, what seeds you can succession plant, and so on. Also, if you look at the back of our packets, we make it really easy because it says warm or cool season. So as long as you know when warm and cool season is, which take a 50-50 guess. Yeah.
So today is this, I'm just curious, we're in January and it was like 80 degrees yesterday. Is that warm season or cool season?
How you're doing. I get it. We're going into our warm season. We're starting all of our warm season crops right now. So that's all of your solanaceae, so your peppers, your eggplants, your tomatoes. You can continue succession planting some of your cool season crops. But the big things that people are thinking about right now are tomatoes, peppers, and eggplants.
Agreed.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, that's one of the things that we struggle with as we start getting into February. People are chomping at the bit to get their plant, to get their garden started. And they demand to have tomatoes in February. But it's a crapshoot.
It is.
Because you can put them out. And if we get a freeze, which does happen in February.
We're supposed to get one tomorrow in Ramona. So it's 80 degrees today. And I was supposed to go out and do tractor work on Sunday. Not going to happen. We could have frozen pipes.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's.
And you have a greenhouse for all your seed starting?
We do. Our greenhouse is actually located at our 10A location, which is much more easier to manage. But yeah.
Sure.
You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman, John Clements, and our special guest, Bridgette Pena from San Diego Seed Company. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back with more Garden Talk right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. Ken Anderson along with George Allman, John Clements, and our special guest, Bridgette Pena from San Diego Seed Company. And she has been filling us in on all kinds of information about growing your own crops from seed and
harvesting, processing.
All of that. Do you want to walk our listeners through how to start growing, how to start plants from seed?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I've done a lot of seed starting workshops, and I think there's kind of like some common questions that pop up, which I think I'll stick to those for the sake of brevity.
Okay.
So the biggest thing that I always like to point out is that you don't have to have a greenhouse. Mm-hmm. In fact, greenhouses can be very complicated if you don't know what you're doing. You know, you can just, they can become like just a fry house. In fact, our greenhouse, we actually abandon it pretty much after June because it gets so hot that then it becomes a place where we dry our seed crops. So seed starting can be very simple. Again, we live in an amazing climate. And for most of the year, you can start seeds outdoors if you're planting the right crops during the right time of year.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you know, a pepper is not going to germinate in January outside. Actually, it could here in our
it
climate.
It could, yeah.
But yeah, it's going to take a long time. So plant a crop in the right time is the most important. And you can plant them outdoors just on a simple table. Or you can do indoors, but if you're going to do indoors, you have to have grow lights, and they have to be the correct grow lights. You have to have good wind flow. I mean, I would love to hear, like, you know, what your bare minimum setup, John, would be in a greenhouse setup. I'm sure you saw botanical gardens. They probably had something amazing. But, you know, ours is just a simple, you know, greenhouse, nothing much to it. But we produce a lot of really good starts out of there.
Well, you talk about grow lights, too. I've never used grow lights myself. I just haven't had a need for it. But I think what a lot of people do when they're using grow lights and they're not as successful with it is they put the lights too far away. Mm-hmm. The mm-hmm. lights have to be very close, like about a foot. Yeah.
And I will say with the new LED lights that are very low wattage, sometimes mm-hmm. it's even like, you know, it might be an inch or 2 inches.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah. The new, very lightweight, kind of cheap lights that have come out post COVID
mm-hmm.
have pretty poor light quality, and they got to be super close. Whereas like the old school large inflorescent, like cannabis lights, mm-hmm. those would burn your plants. So I think what most growers see now is that, you know, they really need to be very close.
Bottom heat. Do you use bottom heat?
So we don't use bottom heat mostly because I don't have enough heat mats, and that goes back into the whole start it during the right time.
Mm-hmm.
You're definitely going to need heat mats if you're trying to start your tomato seeds in January, but mm-hmm. you could do yourself a favor and just wait 30 days, 60 days, okay. and everything's going to be warmer and those seeds will germinate a lot quicker on their own, which, you know, a lot of seed starting is kind of, I look at it kind of like holistic health, you know, just, you got to, you know, eat right, hydrate right, you know, do all of those things. Seeds are the same way. Plant them in the right season, water them when they should, use really high quality seed starting mix. And all of those things are going to just make your success, you know, you'll go from a 2 to a 7, which is those, you know, 3 pieces of advice.
Now, I think sometimes people have no understanding of how difficult it is to operate a greenhouse too. I mean, people ask me all the time because I was an orchid grower and I ran the botanic garden. Listen, greenhouses are a pain in the neck, and really they just become big ovens. And, mm-hmm. and the smaller right. the greenhouse, the more difficult it is. You have to have exhaust fans. You have to have vents, and they literally will just cook everything. I mean, sometimes I've seen temperatures 140 degrees in a greenhouse. And I think, you know, and people want to go out to Costco and buy a little 6x8 yep. greenhouse and think they're going to be raising orchids or something. And I know you're not. It's very difficult. And so, I think just it's easier to just do the trays, do it in the right light. You don't need the bottom heat, but you're right. Do it the right time of year. But you know what happens? People about September, they go, I'd really love some pumpkins for Halloween.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, you should have started in May.
Well,
yeah.
So what's happening right now is sweet peas. Everyone's going, oh, I want to plant sweet peas. To, you know, because right. ours are already blooming.
Mm-hmm.
You plant them in October.
Yes.
So whatever crop you want, you really got to think, you know, 60 to 90 days before to actually get that crop. It's funny that you mentioned the whole greenhouse thing too, because we have a video online where basically I pick our greenhouse apart and tell people, which my husband works at Costco. We have Costco stock, so I probably shouldn't be doing this, but I tell him not to buy the Costco greenhouse because if you don't have all the setup, the electricity and the cross fans and everything else, you're just buying another thing that's just going to make it more difficult for you. At our Ramona farm, there's a beautiful greenhouse. Well, I mean, it's kind of dilapidated, but it's beautiful in a charming way. It's huge. It's like 19 by 36 feet or something crazy. We don't use it mm-hmm. because it was built in the wrong direction, which is hilarious. I hope my landlord's not listening to this. and there's no way to heat it or cool it. It's just, it's such a mess. It becomes storage. Yeah. And people think, oh, look at that greenhouse. Nope, don't use it. In fact, I don't go in there after June because you'll just like...
You can just cook.
You burst into flames.
So when I get these seeds started in that good mix and I'm, you know, I did it at the right time, I'm doing my tomatoes in late February so I can plant them, or my broccoli in August. Do you feed them? How do you water them?
You think about seed starting, there's really like three main steps. First one is germination, getting the seed to break through the soil. And the biggest thing with that is bottom watering with those trays, which I saw you guys have some awesome 10-20 trays now, and using high quality seed mix. With those two tips, you can get seeds to germinate very quickly. Then after germination, you got to get them grown up to a size that you can plant them out. And most seed starting mix doesn't have fertilizer, it has a very little amount. And it's usually in the form, it'll still be water soluble, but it's granular mixed up in the mix. You want to feed them with a diluted amount of liquid organic fertilizer. And I just really love the fish emulsion because you cannot burn. If you get a little heavy handed, it's not a big deal.
You just waste money.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. You just waste money. So fertilizing is key. They have to have fertility. They have to have crosswind. So either a fan, or they got to be outside where the wind is moving them to actually help the turgidity in their cell walls become stronger so they don't just flop over in the garden. And then you can grow them up to a size that you can actually plant them out.
Now, as far as the seed starting soil is concerned, do you mix your own or do you buy it in?
No. So,
okay. I'm sorry, was that a no? Just checking. You weren't clear on that.
Excuse me, that was a hard no. No, I don't mix my, I don't make my seed starting mix because I also could grow my own wheat and make my own beer, but I could, or I could just go to one of the many great breweries around San Diego. You can make your own seed starting mix, but if you're asking me this question about how to start your seeds, you're probably not quite at a level where you should be making your own seed starting mix. And the key thing that will lead you to be unsuccessful is I really like peat moss. I understand it's not sustainable and that's a problem, but peat moss is a fabulous component to good seed starting mix. It's going to naturally be acidic. And so you have to have a pH balancer in that soil. And I don't know, maybe there's some YouTube hack where you can figure out how to like have a little lab in your, you know, in your garage and make it happen. But I'm just going to buy the seed starting mix.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, John, have you ever made your own pH adjusted? You're going to say yes, aren't you?
Yes, a long time ago. But no, it's a pain in the neck.
It's a lot of extra work.
But that was in the days. Remember Butler's Mill?
Yeah.
I used to buy stuff from Butler's Mill and we'd make our own things. But there's just no place to source stuff like that anymore.
No, the only mix that we ever made was we used to make our own cymbidium mix, which was eighth to a quarter inch orchid bark, which is fir bark, not pine bark, and redwood compost.
Yes.
And the redwood compost that we got was from Butler's Mill.
Yes.
And it was a coarser nitrilized redwood compost. And that just, it doesn't exist anymore.
No, an oak leaf mold.
Oak leaf mold was part of my cymbidium mix.
And you can't get oak leaf mold anywhere anymore.
Yeah. And the other one that we used to make, we made a plumeria potting mix, which was basically the same. It was the same redwood compost and pumice. And that was it. And then for the unusual stuff, the more exotic stuff, we made a paphiopedilum growing mix, which was quarter inch fir bark charcoal sponge rock and a handful of all kinds of weird trace elements that, and I can't remember who the name of the grower was that we got the recipe from, but Byron Gear was the one.
He was one
of the greatest paphiopedilum growers that ever existed. But we used to mix that stuff up and we would bag that all up ourselves. And
I bet that was from, oh my gosh, he had Los Osos orchids, a special paphiopedilum grower back then. But,
it wasn't Ray Rands, was it?
No, it wasn't Ray. It was Charles, I think, but I can't remember his last
name right now. Doc Charles.
I think it was Doc Charles.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think that was the mix that we used, way back in the in the day. But yeah, that's a horrible job.
Well, and you just get covered with dust. I mean, you know, just
we would make up, oh my word, like huge piles of cymbidium mix, mm-hmm. and just mix it all up with shovels, and then shovel it into plastic bags.
And now, when you were doing this, I'm assuming you're wearing a respirator.
Oh no!
Yes, of course we had the PPE back then. Well, yes. PPE, what? We never even knew what that was.
So going back to your seeds, though, and you had mentioned that if you're asking about how to start a seed, you probably aren't going to be mixing. Most people are going to, you know, buy a large bag of a seed starter mix and make a six pack of this, a six pack of that. So that makes sense to me. What about pests? Do you're going to snails, slugs, whitefly, things like that? What are your normal methods to take care of that?
Specifically, when we're talking about seed starting in trays, the biggest thing that you can do is just have a good fan or have something be outside where you've got a cross breeze, because that's going to move airflow. Stagnant airflow, which is, you know, rampant in a greenhouse, is going to be more likely to have soil gnats, those annoying little gnats that fly around, and other issues. The big thing that people are dealing with right now, because we're having hot and cold, is dampening off because of the mm-hmm. the colder temperatures. I think it's like 68 degrees is the prime. And you can take care of that very easily by putting a thick layer of perlite or vermiculite, or in a pinch, I'll just use clean new seed starting mix that I put on top of the wet soil to just basically create a layer to keep that dampening from off fungus from crawling up my stems.
You know, can I tell you Uncle John's cardinal rule for what you grow at home? And I tell people all the time, do not grow onions. Do not grow things that you can go buy at the store.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, even garlic. I mean, garlic's cool. But you know what I grow? I want to grow the best, sweetest sugar snap peas ever. Cascadia, Sugar Daddy. You cannot buy those at the store. And the other one that I think is so amazing, Brigitte, is the Kajari melon. George mentioned it earlier. Brigitte gave me some a few years ago, and I put one in a room. The whole kitchen smelled like this sweet melon. You'll never in a million years be able to buy a Kajari melon at the store. So you want to raise at home what you cannot buy.
That is a good rule of thumb. You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements, and our special guest, Brigitte Pena from San Diego Seed Company. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back with another hour of Garden Talk next week.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.